This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. This program contains graphic images and discussion of medical procedures. Viewer discretion is advised.
I'm going to try to briefly go through some evidence around emergent carotid revascularization. Let me just kind of like set the table as to what patients I'm really going to be talking about. So obviously acute stroke has undergone a real sea change in terms of the level of evidence and support of mechanical intervention for these types of patients. I'm not going to be going through the tour de force on that data. I'll touch on it just a little bit at the start. But this is primarily going to be focused on patients who have a cervical carotid occlusion with or without an intracranial component. So we'll go through some cases, then we'll go over some of the etiologies of this particular problem. We'll go over some of the evidence, as I mentioned. We'll talk about some techniques just really briefly, and then some of the medication issues that are going to come up. So this is a patient, 50-year-old gentleman, who has an acute right MCA syndrome. You can see the hyperdense sign there, and then there's the corresponding CTA showing an absence of flow. And then this is the cervical carotid. You can see the commons are filling on both sides on the left, but you can notice there on the right side that the internal is out. So in the emergent setting, what we do is we do an angiogram, and you can see here that the common carotid is occluded. You can see a little bit of distal reconstitution through ophthalmic collaterals. But what we then do is cross the lesion blindly with a microcatheter, and we do a run to then define the intracranial occlusion, which is here at the M1 segment. We then do an embolectomy all above the occluded segment in the neck to reestablish flow to the brain, which again, if you take home one point from this talk, it is that the most important part is reestablishing flow to the brain first and foremost. But then we come down and address what's going on down below. So this patient has a long spiral dissection, which extends into the petrous segment. We did some angioplasty, but that was insufficient to really establish flow, and we ended up putting a couple of telescoping stents there to reestablish flow completely. So juxtapose that case against this case. So again, a right MCA occlusion. But in this case, this patient's about 25 years older. And so this is what the neck looks like in this patient. So both commons are open again on the left. But in this case, both internal carotids are closed. So this is a little more complicated. So this is the cervical injections on both sides, and the ICAs are both out. And this is what the intracranial run looks like. So there's really no flow getting to the brain on either side. And so you can see here, if you do the vertebral injection, the MCA is filling from the PCOM on the left side. But again, this patient has an acute right-sided symptoms. So what we do is, again, we go up above the lesion, do a microcatheter run to define the occlusion on the right side, do an embolectomy. You'll know here that one of the M3 branches is filling slowly, but that was improving. Patient had IV-TPA, so we didn't pursue that. But then we come down and look at the neck. So this patient has a fairly long segment atherosclerotic plaque. And to be conservative, in this case, what we did was angioplasty. We then gave the patient a couple days to recover from their initial stroke, loaded them on aspirin and Plavix. We stented the lesion. You can see now that this branch has filled completely, and then this is just a colorful parametric color-coded map to just kind of replicate that data. So in terms of the etiology, we kind of demographically loosely divide these into two camps. There's the atherosclerotic and atrial fibrillation camp, and then there's the dissection camp. And I think it's important to note that these are two different patient populations, and they're going to have different comorbidities, and thus their natural history, despite the fact that they're both dealing with carotid occlusions, is going to be different. There's just some of the information there about dissection, and obviously it's representative causes, but I'm not going to go into that just because of time constraint. So in terms of the evidence, let's just start with the best evidence we have. So this is a per-patient or individual-patient meta-analysis of the five major randomized controlled trials, which were published in the end of 2014 and early 2015. And so this is really our best information about carotid occlusion and revascularization in the acute setting. And so I showed this data as it relates to age and NIH stroke scale to kind of familiarize yourself with these terms, because you're going to see them over the subsequent slides, to help normalize what these patients look like in terms of their presentation. You should also look at the symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage rates, the mortality. But I showed this first is because a fifth of these patients had an ICA occlusion. And when you look at the pre-specified subgroup analysis in this paper, the biggest impact of mechanical revascularization for acute stroke was in this ICA population. And it underscores how morbid this particular location for occlusion really is because it affects the entire hemisphere. So when you look at the patients with tandem lesions, so these are folks who, again, who have a cervical occlusion and then an intracranial component, which was only about 10% of the patients, they still, you know, received a tremendous amount of benefit relative to the patients who did not. And you can see this in their modified Rankin scores at 90 days after the event. So again, we have good evidence to suggest that treating these patients with tandem lesions is in their best interest. So, but what about patients who just have a cervical occlusion? Because those patients were not included in those randomized controlled trials. Those patients all had to have some sort of intracranial component. We don't have good randomized data here, but this is a nice case-controlled study, which looked at about 650 patients. And again, here's the kind of baseline demographic data, but you can see here that, you know, the percentage of dissection patients has made drop the age just a touch. And what they looked at was intravenous therapy versus some sort of endovascular therapy, whether it's stenting, angioplasty. But one of the big things I want to note is just how many patients received IATPA, and we'll talk in just a second about why that's important. But ultimately, they didn't find a major difference in the outcomes in these patients, all told. They did see some signal when you just looked at the patients who received a mechanical intervention in absence of an IV therapy. But ultimately, the big thing to note is here, the symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage rate is almost 40%, which is very high. And we think that may be in part due to the fact that IATPA was used. And I'll touch about on that back on at the very end of the talk. So in a more recent kind of mixture of these two patient populations that was just published this year, this is a group of 78 patients. You can see 35 of which were tandem and 43 which were cervical only. And overall, actually, the tandem lesions, again, are going to do much worse, but you can see that the baseline presentation is better in the cervical lesions nonetheless. Again, we have a higher rate of symptomatic bleeding in these patients, but again, that's in part related to the fact that these patients probably have to receive a secondary antiplatelet agent if they're getting some sort of cervical intervention. So in the non-treated patients, obviously it's a very small number with tandem lesions, but you can see the cervical patients do much better. But in the treated patients, if you're just looking at the effect of endovascular therapy over IV therapy alone, you can see the delta here is about 20 percentage points. But in the tandem lesions, it's nearly 50 points. And so it just kind of, again, underscores why that intracranial component is so impactful in terms of how it affects patient outcome. So let's talk just a second about technique. I've kind of already loosely referred to some of the methods. Obviously, there's IA thrombolysis, angioplasty, stenting. But just as important is the approach that you take, meaning like what lesion are you going to address first? Are you going to do the neck first and then the head, or the head first and then the neck? So this is our general approach at UCSF. We do all these transfemorally. So this is our 10-French sheath in the groin. This is our triaxial system that we put in the neck. We always use a balloon guide catheter because we feel it gives us better control of any sort of distal embolic issues. We use a large bore intermediate catheter, which allows us to get above those lesions, as you saw in those cases, and then do mechanical intervention above the stenosis before we back and address it. And then this is the standard microcatheter we use to deliver those stent retrievers. The big things to remember when you're doing these techniques is you always need to define the true lumen. Obviously, you're passing a lot of these wires and catheters blindly, so you really want to make sure that you haven't gone into a false lumen or obviously perforated. And then, as I mentioned, you want to get that distal access catheter up as high as possible because it gives you the most freedom to kind of move in and out of a case without having to revascular or reaccess that area. So this is a nice small case series looking at the proximal to distal approach. And again, this is kind of the idea is that you cross the lesion initially with your microcatheter, then you do runs to define the intracranial component as well as the proximal component. You then address the cervical lesion by angioplasty and stenting, and then you go up and have full access to the intracranial component. And obviously, if you go back to their study, they had great TICI scores. TICI scores, you know, are just a reperfusion scale. And you can see their modified Rankins at 90 days, which were quite good. And their symptomatic hemorrhage rates were quite low, relatively speaking, to those other studies. And the mortality was quite good. But just juxtapose that to another case series looking at this case, the distal to proximal approach. Again, here's the kind of the baseline information. Again, you can note there that the relatively younger age of patients who had a dissection versus a non-dissection, and you can again see their numbers for presentation and complication rates. But what they found was ultimately that they didn't need to do as many cervical interventions as they thought. So what they did is they go up and they do their mechanical embolectomy, but when they come back down to the neck, oftentimes they don't have to maybe do as much as they think once they've reestablished flow in the head. They did note that though the TICI scores were lower in the dissection group, ultimately the outcomes were better. But again, I think that may speak to the comorbidities that those patient populations represent. Last but not least, this is a nice little comparison of these two techniques in one series. So here's their baseline information again. Here's their reperfusion and outcome scales. Again, quite comparable to what you've just been seeing. But what they found was that ultimately it was much faster for them to finish the case and get reperfusion of the brain when they used a distal to proximal approach. And what they found ultimately is that translated into better outcomes for those patients. So last but not least, we should talk about medications. This is a very complex issue. I don't think anybody has a standardized approach for this in the acute setting. Obviously, you have to deal with your intraprocedural antiplatelet as well as your postprocedural and when to start those, whether or not you can do single or dual, and then obviously the routes in which those are delivered. We do get some information from a nice study from JAMA Neurology where they looked at a registry of about 85,000 patients, and they looked at that number of patients, that fraction of patients who had some antiplatelet on board prior to their IV tPA administration. And what they found, not surprisingly, is that if you're on an antiplatelet and you receive IV tPA, your rate of symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage is higher. So again, so these agents are potentially putting you at a higher risk for having a symptomatic bleed. But what they also found was that these patients did better. And so this speaks to the synergistic effect of an antiplatelet agent working with a thrombolytic to try to lyse that clot a little bit more effectively. So in conclusion, intervention in the setting is safe and effective and should be performed. But the most important part, again, is you need to focus on revascularizing the end organ. At least in our practice, as much as the neck is clearly an issue to get to the head, we most reliably can get through those occlusions safely, and that allows us to deal with the brain first, and then we go back and down and deal with the neck. Mechanical thrombectomy is really the mainstay of practice now. We try to avoid IA thrombolysis. If you remember back to that slide where two-thirds of those patients were getting it and they had this very high symptomatic bleed rate, we don't have these problems as much as often as we did in the past. I think it's important to recognize what the etiology is. So you want to really look at your patient population, but also look at the images. You want to know if it's a dissection versus some other cause. And then last but not least is the issue of stenting. This is a very heterogeneous space, and there are a lot of different stents. And so every group has a different practice, but you have to really try to find that balance of how you're going to manage the antiplatelet regimen to try to balance hemorrhage versus thrombosis. And so conservatively, what we do is we use a monotherapy for the first 24 hours, and then depending on what the outcome of the stroke intervention is, we'll then put them on dual antiplatelet if they don't have a hemorrhage. Thank you. Yeah, so if I go back here, if I can go back to my slide, I don't have the actual number there, Chuck, but and Wade probably actually has the number on the tip of his tongue. He's just like antsy in his chair because he wants to tell me. But the point is, if you don't intervene on patients who have a carotid occlusion, it's very, very morbid. It's very high. IV tPA puts some dent in that, but that group, and that's what I was trying to show with that first set of data there, they receive far and away the most benefit from these interventions, more so than any other subpopulation based on anatomy or other types of comorbidities. I don't have the precise number, but it's certainly well north of 20%.
56 to 75%.
There you go.
Left
right. Thank you, Ed. To treat it endovascularly? It's a great question. I'm not familiar with the endarterectomy data in the acute stroke setting.
Per occlusion.
One of my first thoughts would be the fact that a lot of these patients are going to be receiving thrombolytics, and I would assume that would make open surgery a more complicated process. But again, I think it speaks to the point I was trying to make at the very end there is by addressing the issue in the brain first, that's really where the rubber meets the road. And though you can work to get the vessels open in the neck very quickly, ultimately it's the brain that really has to be reperfused. And you can sometimes get by with less revascularization in the neck, as you can see in one of the cases I showed. But you can't get away from not getting the brain open.
Well, I think that's Blaisdell's old data. So that's very old data. And I don't think, but I don't remember the paper certainly well enough to know, is how long it took for those patients to finally get operated on. They had to be referred in, et cetera. So these patients, you're willing to engage in this procedure at what time point after their first symptom of stroke?
For the cervical portion? In the same setting.
I mean, No. The patient has a stroke at home. They come in, and you. How much time are you gonna take them on at any time?
So what group out here is actually treating acute stroke, but essentially, time is of the essence, and so we continue. I mean, these patients are literally on a stopwatch, and so you know we're going to take these patients, at least in the anterior circulation, comfortably within the first 6 hours from onset. Some people would push that to 8. Now we have multiple trials that are looking at extending that well past that number because we're looking at the physiology of the brain as opposed to just the strict time limit. But these cases are as fast as humanly possible. And so I think, editorially speaking, I think the practice of stroke intervention is probably going to follow the suit of trauma or the paradigms of trauma where we're going to potentially have to be in-house for these things long-term at large centers because the coin of the realm is time. And if, you know, a person is in-house and is able to reperfuse a person, you know, meaningfully faster because they're there, that's something that we have to talk about. But that's a different topic for a different time. Yes?
Are you doing this just for completely occluded ICAs? What if they have... Say a clot in the MCA, would you do the same techniques for?
Yeah, I mean, again, that's exactly what we're talking about is, yes, we always try to address the intracranial component first to get that addressed. But, yes, this idea was that whether it's a cervical lesion alone or a cervical lesion with an intracranial component, we try to do them both emergently.
Just trying to get a sense of, I don't have this capability in my institution, what clinical parameters or CT angiogram parameters would lead me to get this done expedited in a local institution?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that's going to be governed by their stroke scale and how their clinical presentation is. So obviously patients with a very low stroke scale, you know, who maybe have a very mild symptom, you could delay this and then do it in a subacute setting. But for anybody who has a stroke scale probably at least over 4 or 5, they're going to be kind of channeled into this acute stroke paradigm. Yes?
In San Francisco, L.A., Chicago, there's plenty of neurointerventional radiologists, but there are many areas of the country that are underserved in terms of that specialty. Can you comment on the appropriateness of other interventionalists getting involved in this area and what sort of training paradigm you would imagine for those people who don't have the classic training in neurointerventional procedures?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's certainly a sticky one. I think there are people who are purists who would say that, you know, if you have not gone through the full, you know, ceremonial process of you know, a formal neurosurgical pathway or neurology pathway or neuroradiology pathway, that you probably shouldn't be doing this. But that doesn't speak to the practice out there in the community, as you're saying. There are plenty of places that are underserved that desperately need this kind of coverage. And, you know, we often get this type of question. I guess my short answer is it's going to depend. I think the big thing there is a critical mass in terms of doing these cases where you have to be comfortable because complications in this space are very, very grave. All it takes is one bad case where you perforate or you have a massive hemorrhage, and it'll really damper your enthusiasm from wanting to do this. Not to speak of the fact that, like, being on call all the time for this is very, very injurious to anybody's social life. I think this is one of these issues that is yet to be determined. So right now, because this evidence is so strong for making the case of endovascular treatment for acute stroke, all centers, or at least many centers, are trying to get this coverage. But I think what they'll find ultimately is that there's a break point where if you're doing maybe one or two cases a year, the difficulty in terms of staffing that and providing the resources, it, not even mentioning the technical issues with only seeing one or two cases a year, is ultimately not worth it. And you're better off actually pushing that patient to a higher center where they do more volume. But that's not a great answer. I can talk offline, but I think that's probably the best I can do.
Real quick, what do you think about direct carotid access for this procedure?
Right. So, you know, Wade brought that up just a second ago. We have never had, I mean, speak, not probably just I'm on call this week, and I've now just jinxed myself. Never had a case that we couldn't actually get to the arch into the cervical segment. I have done direct carotid sticks for other situations, but not for acute stroke, so it's not that we're abhorrent to the idea. But I think it does speak to our level of comfort as doing these cases. This is one where I would call Warren, I would call, you know, one of my colleagues and say, look, I cannot get up this guy as a dissection, or there's something going on in the aorta that I simply can't get there. Can you help me through this? But my skill set is not one where I could just do a cut down quickly, especially in the setting of IV TPA. And then the one other thing I think should really be mentioned is the compliance, or the ability of these patients to stay still. So every one of these patients we treat now are under conscious sedation. In fact, all we usually give them is lidocaine at the groin. So these patients are moving a lot, because a lot of them are aphasic. They are not following commands. So these cases actually look more in practice like a cardiology case, where you're doing everything under live fluoro because they're moving so much, you can't even see what's going on. So the idea of trying to do a direct carotid cut down in a patient who's moving this much, I think would be very difficult, in part because, again, the use of general anesthesia is something we're trying to avoid now, because the evidence suggests that that actually contributes to a poorer outcome for these stroke patients.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.